Thanks very much, everyone. So for our last presentation of the day, but definitely not the least, we all know Chris very well. He's a consultant in the Milliman office of Johannesburg, the lead consultant on non-life insurance and employee benefit valuations for Milliman in Africa. He's got more than 15 years experience across a wide variety of practice areas, and we're really looking forward to this practical guide on reinsurance optimization. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you so much, Herman. And thank you, everyone, for sticking out with me and having me back here to present again. Thank you especially to Asa and the committee for this opportunity. Look, let's be honest, it's been a long day. Very insightful day, but now I'm tired. So I think I'm going to go for the expedited version of this presentation. I'm going to say it now up front already. Of course, please do ask questions at the end. Anybody else who, or if there's anything that I didn't quite cover in detail or you want to know more about, very happy to catch up afterwards, either here or by email. Look for me, I'll be holding a beer. Right, so kicking off, talking about a topic that I personally find quite interesting regarding reinsurance, especially discussing, well, how can you look at it from an optimization point of view? So why am I discussing this today? All right, pretty much every time you look at the news article, there's always some massive event, some new thing that had picked up. It's not just the big storms, though. We know that there's also a significant increase in the frequency of the events. I mean, just in terms of the size, I just picked kind of a few of the largest ones that we had seen in the past few years. Actually, the newsletter that came up this week that Zante referenced, there's an article there from Nadine that also pointed out that it's over $1 billion in insured losses for the four consecutive years now. So there's a lot of catastrophic events. It is hitting the insurance industry. I had in the past wondered that, is this not a factor of, because of social media and news coverage, we're just hearing about more, there isn't actually more? Well, no. Really, any broker report, any reinsurer would have had a graph like this. It's always showing that we do have the increase, not just in the extreme scenarios, but also in the frequency of catastrophic events in general. So what this means is reinsurance comes with a cost. Look, let's be honest. The economy couldn't function without insurance. Insurance couldn't function without reinsurance. Reinsurance has limited capacity, does come with a cost. We had been feeling it over the course of the past few years, where South Africa had typically been considered a bit of a low-risk diversification benefit for reinsurers. Since 2017, really, we'd been seeing that, well, knock after knock after knock, and costs have been coming in. Should mention, there definitely is some hope on the horizon. Starting last year already, and especially now looking at the most recent renewals, we have seen a softening in the reinsurance market. Prices have come down. I don't think excesses really have come down, but we have seen a softening of the reinsurance rates. Doesn't change the fact that, as always, it is good to be sure that is your reinsurance operating at the level that is giving you, the company, the best benefits? All right, so pretty much what I'm planning on for the presentation today is really three, kind of just like call it a literature study, just kind of giving context of reinsurance. I then do want to talk about the ability of optimizing for your reinsurance portfolio. And then I'd say for those that have already done something similar, hopefully add something else, some additional insight that I had the benefit of learning recently from a fellow Milliman colleague. All right, so starting from the start, why use reinsurance? Fundamental question. I'd say most of us do know this, but just running through them very quickly. We know that reinsurance, you have access to their expertise and market insight to help with your pricing assumptions or benefit design structure, whatever the case is. By getting your reinsurer to actually underwrite your book, it's a very good independent check for them to want to show that, well, your rates aren't out of line. They wouldn't enter into a business if your rates were completely wrong. So it's a good way to actually just sense check, as I said, the fact that they're willing to put skin in the game. They, of course, provide liquidity, and they provide capital benefit. I'm going to touch, actually, on Riyadh's presentation. There was quite a few points mentioned there that I'll touch on later. As I say, decreased capital. We have always still decreased failure of risk, probability of ruin. Reinsurance is there to help a reinsurer actually survive the difficult periods. improve return on capital, and of course, decrease volatility of earnings. Really, the important point here is this order, although applicable to all insurers, is going to be a different order of importance for different insurers, depending on their circumstances. All right, now a much more pertinent question, when to use reinsurance. Now, reinsurance, at the end of the day, is nothing other than a capital management tool. So you can consider it in the context of the capital management framework when considering when you should use insurance. And there's really four main pillars to deciding on a capital management approach or option. Identify the key performance indicators and the key risk areas or key risk indicators that you are trying to solve for or that you are trying to address. Your performance indicators, these would be more the operational things like dividend payments, your liquidity, things like your operational aspects. Where your key risks indicators, this will be your solvency, your liquidity, I mentioned that previously, but your risk indicators to show something is going wrong. Having identified those, identify what trade-offs are there if you choose this one over another one in terms of a capital management option. At the end of the day, there's always very different options that you can choose. Any one means you're not choosing another one. So it helps to know what you are sacrificing in favor of the one you choose. Third aspect is then how that changes, if it can evolve, the trade-offs. Is there something there that you need to consider? And finally, when is the right time to implement it, depending on, what is your strategic plan or your expectation over the coming period? So with that background, how can we apply this in the context of reinsurance? All right, so when you're evaluating a reinsurance strategy, really the way I see it is there's three broad categories that you can put it under. It's your capital considerations, your profit and loss considerations, and the implementation and approval of cover, kind of the process around it. All right, so first talking to the capital requirements considerations, I mean, first and foremost is what is the impact on your capital requirements of introducing the reinsurance? We expect that it is going to help you with reducing capital. One consideration there is you might lose out on diversification if you, for example, insure one line of business that had been diversifying another line of business. You are losing that. Again, bit of a fringe case, but just something to bear in mind. The additional risks introduced, I mean, yeah, by far the most common is your counterparty default risk. Basis risk, of course, is another one if your reinsurance payout isn't aligned to your actual exposed to risk. The renewals that are required. Yeah, actually, Riyadh's presentation touched on the point that if you put reinsurance in place, we typically assume that we're going to have that reinsurance going forward. So if it is for the sake of managing your capital, one thing that we've seen is you specifically introduce something because you want to be able to pay out a dividend, as an example. If you've now paid out that dividend, you've now reduced the level of your capital, and now you can't renew it come a year later for whatever reason, capacity, cost constraints. The problem is you're now at that lower capital level, and you feel the impact of having to revise that up. Okay, then profit and loss considerations. Okay, this bit of a, I want to say goes without saying, but it's worth remembering the cost of reinsurance. You need to take all aspects of the cost into account. It's not just the cost of the reinsurance premiums. It is the reinstatement premiums. It's the return commission that you are getting, the collateral potentially. Just that ensure when you are doing the calculation to see efficiency, allow for all components. The capital generation, what this point is, you can reduce your capital with reinsurance, which means the return on net asset value can be improved through introducing reinsurance. Your profit and loss volatility, I mean, the reinsurance helps just stabilize between different periods, so it can help just in terms of giving confidence for your investors. And nobody really likes that. Nobody likes too volatile results year on year. And your timing and dividends, what this means is you do have you have a bit more certainty kind of linking to your volatility. And just in terms of implementation and approval of cover, the time required to implement. If it is a new reinsurance treaty or a reinsurer that you are using, remember to account for the fact that there is going to be time that you have to perform the due diligence on the reinsurer, contract signing, all of those delays. If it is for renewal, it is reinsurance renewal for year end, the problem is you'd need that reinsurance in place as at that first day of, well, the new reinsurance period. More often than not, I've seen that you can very much go up against that timeline if there had been delays or waiting for additional data, or the biggest risk, there was a large catastrophe event just before renewal that can push out the delay. Again, just bear in mind that it is the time constraint of it. The availability, this is specifically in terms of if there are certain structures that aren't available more than other structures. It's a bit more prevalent in the rest of Africa where there's, for example, less excess of loss and more quota share, just limitations and cost implications there. And of course, regulatory approval. Yeah, very important that you need to be able to prove to your regulator it's not just smoke and mirrors, you are truly transferring risk. Okay, then, topic that comes up from a few clients and from my own experience, a few reinsurance myths that I'd like to discuss and, try and unpack. Myth one, I don't want to use reinsurance because I don't want to pay away my profits. I'm surprised the number of times that I've encountered where, when you're discussing with an insurer, they're comfortable with the idea that insurance to the policyholders, we get a profit from them, but then very confused that you reinsurer wants a profit because reinsurance should pay for you. Again, reinsurance, on the best estimate, you are paying the reinsurer for that provision of capital. And the thing is, you can have reinsurance or return commission included in the contract where you are writing particularly profitable business so that there is more of a sharing in the profits between both parties. Financial reinsurance can dramatically improve solvency by increasing assets without increasing liability. This is normally a red flag for us when we see that there isn't a net increase or decrease from financial reinsurance. It's normally for us a bit of a concern around, but are we accounting for everything that we should be accounting for? For fear of treading on a few toes, don't take audit or regulatory advice from the person selling you the structure. It's probably good to just get an independent view of it as well. And yeah, and this actually very much speaks to the fact that you need to ensure that you are accounting for the true view or the true impact that it has on your business. There's actually a part of the FSIs, the for non-life underwriting risk, the optional adjustment, that speaks to this point about allowing for amplification and absorbing, that you are reflecting the true position of risk transfer. There's part of the SAM phase 2 subgroup that is working on a guidance note on this to actually clarify and provide more information to ensure that we are allowing for it appropriately. Myth 3, financial reinsurance has no benefit under IFRS 17 because you have to show a liability. Well, no, financial reinsurance still has very much the benefit of providing you finances right now so that you can meet your liquidity constraints. Does still have that benefit, just not necessarily the benefit that some people want to try and force it. Reinsurance can smooth earnings between periods. Reinsurance smooths volatility between periods. This is more applicable actually for life and for like long-term contracts, that you can't in this year account for the profits that you're only going to earn next year. Again, you're not smoothing your earnings, you're smoothing the volatility of period for extreme events. My claims basis was set from with input from the reinsurer, so it must be appropriate. Back to the point about having access to expertise, yeah, the reinsurer does have a lot of insight and a lot of market practice. But again, it's not necessarily going to align to your company's specific experience, given your your market that you are exposed to or whatever the case is. So don't hide behind the fact that while the reinsurer gave us the rates, it should be fine. It's always monitor and check the actual versus expected. Profit share, profit commission, sliding scale get me significant capital benefits at a low cost. So again, ties into the part of the financial re-one. Profit commissions is a very valuable place where an insurer and a reinsurer can't agree on the claims experience that you are expecting. And therefore, it allows for the possibility that if experience is better, as the insurer believes, than what the reinsurer expects, the profit is returned. But again, be sure to account for the actual risk transfer. Yeah, I am really also speaking to the optional adjustment one. There actually was a presentation for those of you that were around, might remember, in 2021, STIC convention on this topic of a sliding scale commission and allowing for it. I'm sure you can access it. Though, take it with a pinch of salt, the presenter is a bit dodgy and was more than a bit nervous. Okay, last one. No matter how bad climate change gets, we can always pass on the risks to the reinsurer and pass on the costs to the policyholders. Something we've come across a lot now recently when we're doing, considering climate change from Milliman Global. Again, there's limited capacity of reinsurance in the market. There are examples of the reinsurers exiting markets in America already, the California wildfires and the Florida hurricanes. At a certain cost, when a section of the book becomes uninsurable and a reinsurer exits, if you as insurer can exit, great, but there could be regulatory constraints or other business considerations that means that you still need to be active in the market and then without the benefit of reinsurance. Okay, getting to the actual thing I want to talk about in my reinsurance presentation, and I realized this slide's topic should have been a lot better. I talk here about optimizing using simulation software. The point actually is optimizing using your own claims experience and using freely available software, specifically in R. So where this comes from is the fact that, look, your reinsurance brokers, they are really the ones who are going to be doing looking at your book and helping you pick the best structure, given your risk profile, given your risk appetite. Thing, though, is the value of being able to have your own verification of some of the results that you are seeing. It is to have the verification. It's also to be able to test some scenarios that the reinsurance broker isn't necessarily testing, or if you just want to have a quick check of validity of, test out a new structure. I mention R because really it's the benefit here is you can use your own claims data, and given the packages that we are seeing there, and especially the benefit of ChatGPT, I can go on a lot about that, I won't, but with ChatGPT you really can code a lot easier. We can try and test different structures using own claims data. So, taking you through how I want to do that, it's based on frequency and severity modeling. I must say, with my background in corporate actuarial, I haven't been as exposed to this as I would have as a pricing actuary. So I should caveat this as this is looking at it from an external point of view of you don't have access to sufficient data to be doing very sophisticated pricing. If you have access to claims data and you have access to exposure, you'll be able to replicate this approach. So for frequency and severity modeling, some of the factors that you would need to consider, if, as I said, you have obtained now your claims and exposure data, you'll want to split your claims data into the different portfolio, i.e. your different lines of business, and different sublines of business, so that you're able to model the claim characteristics that the groups that associate with one another. The reinsurance cover, this links a little bit to the subline of business as well. If you want to test reinsurance structures that's only applicable or that only cover a certain portion of a line, so for example, it's property versus commercial, you're only covering commercial with your reinsurance, you'll want to be able to split out the claims on that level as well. Claims inflation and book growth, having picked the investigation period, always bearing consideration of credibility versus reliability of the amount of years of data that you want to base this on, would need to allow for claims inflation. Would also need to allow for the fact that claims inflation typically is to ensure that your severity is appropriate. Book growth is to ensure that your frequency is appropriate, to just adjust and normalize over the investigation. And importantly, you're going to want to adjust it for your expectation into next year as well. Currency movements, less relevant if you're only in South Africa. This was just an interesting complication that if you have exposure to different countries and they experience currency movements, what portion of the claims is linked to their currency, where you would expect it's the labor costs, which portion is linked to the dollar currency that would apply for inflation, for the sake of repair, your pots. Your claim size, this is also a big consideration when you are splitting up your book. It's very rare that you're going to find one distribution that fits for a line of business across the whole distribution, across all claim sizes. So typically what you would want to consider is fitting different distributions for different claim sizes. Normally you'll want to pick, well, could be one, could be 2 points that you pick, such that you are fitting different distributions for them. Again, which one you pick is going to depend very much on credibility to ensure that you, reliability to ensure that you have enough data points given the split, and where it makes sense so that the claims that are grouped together follow similar characteristics. And just last one, where you are fitting the distributions, is it on annual or monthly data? Again, this is going to be depending on the level of granularity and the volume of data that you have, whether you can get on annual or if you can get on monthly, arguably a bit more detailed, a bit more reliable, again, subject to the volumes that you have. Having done these adjustments to your claims data, we can then fit distributions for frequency and severity. And typically for frequency, you would have your Poisson, you would have your negative binomial. I said normal, but not really normal, because normal we know can go negative. So at least you would have to normalize it or introduce a link function if you want to go with that route. For your severity, gamma, log normal, Weibull. I found gamma is typically valuable, but again, depends on the underlying. And then where all of this comes together is when you have fitted the distribution to your claims, you can perform simulations using those distributions. The goal here really is to do a simulation of your expected claims experience in the next year based on your past few years' claims experience on a gross level so that you can apply different reinsurance structures and to test the impact of them for your book. Okay, how do we assess them? Typically, we will look at 4 measures. We do first look at the mean to get an idea of, well, what is our best estimate? What do we expect? Or what is the reasonable expectation of the performance of your reinsurance? We'd want to look at the 1 in 4 or the 25th and 75th percentile just to get a feel for the risk that experienced. Your 1 in 20, I found that this is useful if you're having discussions kind of with the board and management to say that, well, what is the once or twice in your career kind of thing that you could, well, or 3 times, what is the kind of thing that could experience if things really go wrong? 1 in 200, it's more useful to see it as a proxy for capital implications, that you would want to look at this return period as well when comparing. Again, it's not going to be the capital. Your capital will be your SAM calculations. This serves as a useful secondary check from economic capital. That actually leads me to my second point. When you are looking at these percentiles, do you look at them on a gross of reinsurance or a net of reinsurance basis? They should be similar, but there will be differences. If you simulate all of your claims now with this distribution, on a gross level, you're not necessarily going to get the same 75th percentile as you would on a net basis after applying reinsurance. Gross is typically what you would see for deterministic capital calculations, so what you would see under Solvency II or for economic capital. You would simulate what is your experience and then apply the treaty. When we had done this in the past is we've actually considered rather looking at the percentile for net, your net underwriting performance, because this is the thing that really impacts your P&L. This is what you would really base your decisions on, and you want to know at that point what is the impact of different structures. So looking at a practical example, let's say we want to optimize a property portfolio that has the following characteristics. It's personal and commercial, both split 80-20. Your budgeted premiums for, I just realized I did this slide last year. Your budgeted premiums for 2026 is 750 million. Your budgeted claims is 55%. And let's assume the current reinsurance structure, there's 2 treaties. You have a catastrophe excess on loss covering both. And you have a 50% commercial, 50% quota share on the commercial subline of business with a sliding scale reinsurance commission structure. All right. Having got all of the claims data, fitting the distribution, when you want to fit the distributions to them, this is where R has very many packages to try and help with fitting it. Yeah, I want to advise Fit Distribution Plus. It's a very powerful package built in R, accessible. Really, it's what I had used that had helped me the most. Now you need to see which distributions are the best fit for having split your claims into those different buckets. You'd want to look at just doing a histogram plot to see how your claims are looking. There is a lot of goodness of fit tests built in already. where you want to see, well, based on that, how you can, your maximum likelihood estimate to fitting based on that. What we had seen, I mean, the quote that I heard the other day, the difference between theory and practice is that in theory they're the same, in practice they are not. You are going to be limited by the claims data that you have. So goodness of fit test, very important. Failing that, especially we are dealing with lines where there is very sparse data, the value is you want to try and fit the distribution that most closely coincides to the actual observations in according to the moments where your different moments, your first moments are more important. So try and match so that you have your mean standard deviation and skewness, and only then kurtosis. Kind of in that order is the general guide or rule of thumb. QQ plot, of course, always a valuable thing just to ensure that you are fitting as you should, or the fit is sufficient. All right. Then, in terms of how you would go about simulating the distributions, is pick 50,000. So for 50,000 simulations, for the personal line of business, simulate the number of claims from the using the personal frequency distribution that you fit, and then for each of those, each number of claim, or for the number of claim that you simulated from that, simulate a corresponding severity for each one of the personal severity distribution. Repeat this for the commercial line, and then if you had done this using annual data, using monthly data, this will give you the results for 1 month. This is then where it is important if you had done it monthly or annually. If you had done using monthly data, you'd simply need to introduce an additional one to say, well, do it for 12 times. Because then each one of those simulations would be equivalent to 1 year's expected financial results, simulating 50,000 times. I can already hear my colleague, that's a much better R programmer than I am. It's not what you're supposed to do in R, you're not supposed to loop. But again, this is the kind of easier way to explain is in looping context, at least that's what I'm familiar with. All right, in terms of now optimizing the product, I'm going to be showing a few slides that look with this table. So the mean, it's going to be, yeah, that's our best estimate of the 50,000 simulations. They show the 1 in 4, 25th and 75th percentile, a 1 in 20, and the impact at our proxy for capital requirements. Okay, so first, gross premiums are the same at each one of those return periods, the 750 million assumed. We read up the gross claims that we had simulated, and we can calculate our claims ratio. Here already, we see our first point of information that we can use. You may recall I mentioned that our budgeted claims ratio for next year is 55%. Here we see 58%. This either means there's something in the fitting of the claims that we need to relook at, or more valuable is it could be that the budgeted claims ratio is a bit optimistic. So it's useful just to bear that in mind. It's a budget. There's no reason for it. It's good if it's optimistic, but it is useful just to kind of phrase the narrative when discussing. All right, that's just the gross results. Looking at the experience from the claims. So here we are now applying the current reinsurance treaties that we have to try and see, okay, well, what is our expectation given the different return periods? As you would expect, the number of claims that attach to the excess of loss goes up for the higher return periods, higher corresponding claims that are being ceded to the treaty. And similarly, your claims ceded to your commercial quota share also increases. Okay, so then we are able to derive our net claims, just difference between gross and ceded. You may notice, well, actually, no, that the gross claims column here doesn't quite correspond to the gross claims columns in the previous slide. And that is to the point about are you reading off based on the gross claim simulated or the net claim. So we're actually going back to show that they're similar, going from 380 to 694. Similar, but not quite the same. Again, just note, just important to note these which approach you pick and kind of the limitations thereof. All right, so that's just on the claim side. Now bringing into the other side of the equation the costs. So for our catastrophe excess of loss, your reinsurance premium is going to stay the same at each return period of, call it, 10 million. Your reinstatement premium goes up because of the by the return periods based on the amount of claims that you see, reinstatement that you have to introduce, giving you the total excess of loss premium. For your quota share, similarly, premiums that you see stay the same. Your sliding scale commission, though, goes down as you go up in your return period, given that higher claims experience means you get less return commission. And typically, it would flatten out. Most sliding scales do have an upper and a lower bound, so you'll be on the same level past a certain return, return period, giving you a total quota share premium. All right, now getting to the actual result. So we've seen the gross premiums less gross claims gives you our gross result. This in itself doesn't really mean much. But if we then bring in our premium that we ceded, our claims that we had recovered, and the commission that we had received, this then is really what we are trying to work towards, the reinsurance cost. So as we would intuitively expect, at the mean level, it is costing us money, this particular reinsurance structure. As you go down the return period, and especially when you start getting at the very high return periods, the capital level, we're seeing that the reinsurance structure is doing what it's supposed to be doing. We are actually claiming back from it more than what we are paying for it. Again, at the higher return periods. We also get a sense of, well, what is the expected a reasonable level of expected variance at the 25th and 75th percentile levels. So this is the financial impact. It's also with considering the balance sheet impact, the balance sheet impact, statement of financial position, to say that, okay, well, the improvement in your capital requirement, if we look at it on a gross level, a good measure that you can use here is to say the simulated claims, what is that as a proportion of your net asset value? Because that'll give you a view of, well, what portion of your assets can be at risk from your simulated claim for this line of business, so that you know kind of the extent to which you would need to source additional capital. This shows that we have our difference to the mean at the capital level is about 280 million. Looking at the net position, introducing reinsurance takes it down to about 220. And this year, these two numbers shows us that with the current reinsurance structure, we are actually in a position where we are reducing our capital requirement by 60 million. All right, so that's basically how we want to look at one line of business. So what's next? We want to now apply the same fitting of distributions and simulating, calculating the results for your different lines of business so that we can see, well, what is the overall expected result, financial result for the next year? If you have a whole account treaty, if there's a reinsurance that covers everything actually, you'll need to combine all of the lines, in other words, simulate everything and then combine, apply the reinsurance treaties that would come first, to which it inures, in order to calculate the whole account. All right, and this is now the first very big limitation that I've been ignoring up till now. Whether or not these claims or lines of business are independent and identically distributed. So where I had now previously said, well, model each, add them together, here we are assuming that they are independent. Chances are they are not. There is going to be a level of correlation between the different lines. So you would want to look at your underlying claims experience additional external data you can use to kind of justify what correlation you need to allow for when modeling and adding the lines of business together. Yeah. And then really where all of this comes together is you've simulated the claims, you know what your projected gross is at the return periods, you can apply your current reinsurance structure. Now apply different reinsurance structures. This is a useful way in order to see that while moving different programs, different treaties, different deductibles, what is the financial impact at your mean level and the shock periods? What is the impact at your capital levels, your economic capital levels, at the 1 in 200 level as well? Now the limitation here that gets introduced is if there are major changes in what you're using, to the structure, you're not going to be able to approximate the reinsurance cost impact. You're likely going to have to get this from your reinsurance brokers to source from them, or for them to source from reinsurers. Small changes you can likely approximate, but again, for the big ones, would need to get their input in order to be able to make an informed decision on the reinsurance structure for optimization. Okay, and then lastly, also another big limitation, events not in the data. So what we've been doing now is we're looking at the claims from our own claim experience. Now, again, this is why reinsurance brokers are absolutely critical when it comes to choosing your reinsurance and optimizing, and especially looking at your upper limit. The reinsurer broker approach isn't looking at your claim experience, but rather your expected exposure over the next year to understand size of your book, where are they geographic base, what is the risk exposure. This approach that I'm presenting here really is to serve as a secondary sense check and own interpretation using your own claims data. But you have the major limitation that you're only going to be able to model using your own data and not allowing for the kind of the big claims that aren't there. And that is where extreme value theory can come in and help us. So as I mentioned, I was fortunate that earlier this year I attended a company conference where a colleague of ours presented on extreme value theory, that they have been doing a lot of work on it. For those of you that have done F106, this might be a bit PTSD, you would recognize this book of Paul Sweeting. It does have a chapter on extreme value theory, but there's actually this book by Stuart Coles that really the whole book is dedicated to it, to really test in detail of, what it entails, the limitations, and how you can apply it. The whole book, the whole principle of extreme value theory is actually based on the central limit theorem. Central limit theorem is, recalling from varsity days, the stating that sample means of a sequence of independent and identically distributed random variables will converge to a normal distribution at n goes to infinity. And this is kind of the underlying crux of the extreme value theory argument. We don't have to worry about what the distribution is from which we are sampling the means, because the sampled means themselves will converge to a normal distribution. Similarly, for extreme value theory, we don't actually have to worry about what is the distribution that is followed by the low frequency, high severity claim events, because extremal types theorem states that if the block maxima, what that means is when you fit your distribution on the existing claims data, you will take all of your claims, fit a distribution. Extreme value theory is you break up your data into blocks. What those blocks are, depending on the context, might make more sense. If it's rainfall, for example, the blocks could be day or week or month. If it's insurance claims, it could be, also months, could be weeks, it could be different cycles. But from that block, you only take the largest loss. And then that largest loss taken from each one of those blocks, that is what's referred to as the block maxima. If the block maxima of a sequence of independent and identically distributed random variables converges to a non-degenerate probability distribution as n goes to infinity, then it must be a generalized extreme value distribution, regardless of the distribution. And this is the point. We don't have to worry about the underlying distribution. It's a very valuable method to fit a distribution, a generalized extreme value one, in order to get a sense of the simulated losses at those very high events. There's a second one. The limitation of the, call it the generalized version, is that you're throwing away a lot of data because you're only picking the maximum from each block. There could be that in a particular block there happens to be two major events, but you're only using one. There's an extension to this, a corollary, to say that if there's a sequence of IID variables, and they do satisfy ETT, so they are block maxima does converge to a generalized extreme value distribution, then for a large enough a threshold point, the threshold exceedance defined by x minus u, where given x is greater than u, will converge to a generalized Pareto distribution. Basically, all that this means is it's a second way that you are able to incorporate the underlying data or not throw away the large losses to fit this this extreme value distribution, where we don't have to worry about what the underlying distribution is to get a view of what are those large claims that we can be exposed to? So, as I said, I had the benefit of, well, I was, when I heard this presentation, I took an interest in it to see how can I use this to enrich an exercise where I tried to optimize it. And when I say I was, if I say I was empowered by it and I liked it, what I mean with that is I shamelessly stole this slide from her presentation for my own purposes. I did ask her. But the point is, what they did with this extreme value theory, and that's actually what's covered in the Stuart Cole's book, is the Harvey hurricane from a few years ago. The question there is, could the amount of rainfall that was experienced there have been predicted based on past data? This really is speaking to the problem of a black swan event. If we don't have the data, event's not in data, how can we predict it? And then the extension of that actually rather is, it's not about can you predict the size? It's to get a better feeling of was that hurricane or that Harvey event, hurricane event, a 1 in 20 year or a 1 in 100 year? Like, is it unreasonable that that could have happened? That, you know, that really was a 1 in 100. This is why we have capital. Or could it be at the 1 in 20 level already, so that you know, no, you should be able to account for that for your volatility in your earnings. So the important point of the extreme value theory is, you're not going to use this in isolation. It's not replacing the distributions that you fit in the previous section that I had showed, but rather you can use this as an explicit add-on. And I'll talk to that just now. The point here again, the benefit is, there's already packages in R that can help you with this. The ISMEF package, it's actually the one that accompanies the Stuart Cole's book, and kind of as a working example, is a bit outdated now because it isn't receiving regular maintenance, but there are other packages that are readily available that can also be used to fit GEVs and the Pareto, generalized Pareto distributions to claims data. And then this is the point, is that you can test what range is feasible for our different return periods. So I applied this to my set of data, and what I was able to see, what I looked at is, fit a GEV to the data, and then give me the expected claims at the different return periods, but not just the point estimate. I want to know what is the 2.5th percentile confidence interval and the 97.5th percentile confidence interval in order to get the whole range of expected extreme values at the different return periods. And it gives me a wide range, as we would expect. But the insight that this already provides us is, at the 1 in 20 range, we know that a 20 million claim it's not unreasonable. My boss would hit me, he hates that phrase. But again, it's not unreasonable to assume that a 20 million claim actually can occur at the 1 in 20 event. Similarly, when you look at the higher return periods, you get a feel for, well, again, the higher you go, the wider the range is. But again, you have an understanding of what is explicit additional add-on should I allow for when optimizing my structure. So going back to this slide that I had, where I show for the number of claims attaching. So here I can already see at the 1 in 20, I had assumed two events, and those two together gave me, well, it's an average of just of like 17 million for the event. Given the range that I have here, it's probably a bit on the low side. It's not expected. I mean, the distributions that I had fit to it would be weighted lower, given the lack of data that I have. So if I am going to be optimizing my reinsurance, it's worth considering, what if I add in another 20 or 30 million rand claim at this level? At the 1 in 200 level, where I'm saying I've got four claims at 45, and I compare that to my 1 in 100, probably means I need to go and dig a little bit. Or again, I want to say dig more into how I had fitted the claims or not. It again relates to the fact that there is limitations with what you can test with your own claims data. Yeah, very importantly, and this is what we always say, as useful a test as this is to get a sense of optimizing for your best estimate and for your capital implications, it's certainly not what you would want to use for the upper limit of your reinsurance structure. That is where your reinsurer broker advice comes in absolutely critical based on the underlying exposure. All right, so just going again to this slide, as I had said, the limitations of event starting data. Extreme value theory is a useful one that can be used to implement it. Certainly one that I want to investigate a bit more. Still would want to consider other limitations, or still want to consider other external data sources that you would want to incorporate in your analysis to make sure that you have a good sense of optimizing different reinsurance structures. Okay, that's what I have for you today. Thank you again. Very happy to take any questions, but otherwise, again, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Chris, for those practical examples that you shared with us there. We've got a question from the online audience saying, in your simulation, did you check if the median is closer to the expected claims ratio of 55%?
Yeah, so as I said, this is the, as you are fitting the data, you want to make sure that throughout the whole process, all of your metrics do align to make sure that you had fit correctly. For this particular one, no. I had seen that it wasn't fitting well to that 55%, which already was kind of an indication that 55 is probably optimistic.
Okay, thanks for that. Any other questions from the floor?
Hi, Chris. Thank you for the presentation. As you mentioned, there was a bit of a softening with the latest renewal. Do you think it's possible for deductibles on excess of loss treaties to lower? And what advice would you give for insurers that negotiate for such?
So I would certainly say there is, I wouldn't say there is not scope. It really does boil down to the reinsurance capacity and their perception of risk. As I said, South Africa had always been, was until recently considered a very nice diversification benefit. And we really started feeling that. And the problem was, it was actually very difficult for the insurers to make peace with the higher deductibles because they were used to the very low ones that reinsurers were willing to offer to get into the South African market. So based on that, I would say that if I had to put money on it, they wouldn't lead with it because it's one of those things of once it's been introduced, very difficult to take it away for fear of if they are starting to lower again, having to worry about picking it up. I do think you likely will have more, it's more likely for it to be for the premiums. I say that, although I mean, there are very many insurers here that would have gone through their renewals now, and please do correct me, or please do let me know if there had been reductions in the deductible. In terms of the advice to give there, I mean, it really is, follow the fortunes, it's a common phrase in reinsurance. If your business is profitable, then it helps the reinsurer be profitable. And they're going to be much more willing to get that business from you. In order to show that, the best advice that I had seen is the better your data is, the more comfort the reinsurers have that they are pricing accurately on it. So I think that really is the first point of call is if you are able to provide them with sufficient data, with sufficient comfort of your underlying pricing, it'll be a lot easier to negotiate the reinsurance rates.
Okay, thanks. Maybe something from my side, Chris, which sparked when you were talking. Yeah, like we said, it is a softening market. People are willing to enter it again, but we know these things are cyclical. 2-3 years ago, it was completely the opposite story and maybe one or two big claims. And then also against the backdrop of, and I'm not saying but, like Bruce said this morning, and against the backdrop of, you know, the reinsurers not being willing to carry our political risk of a grid failure on their balance sheets. And we all got hit with the grid failure exclusions. We've got the landmark Toyota case going on now in KZN, so that's also going to be very interesting. Maybe just, especially when you said at the beginning, we think we can just keep on passing risks on to the reinsurers and they're just always going to be there. Just some thoughts from your side on this and how it's going to impact us looking forward, and then maybe what should we as an industry or as actuaries do more, because this is potentially a very serious thing. We can't operate without reinsurers.
Thank you for that, Herman. And just want to check the time because you can keep me here for a while because, yes, we have covered that topic quite a bit internally. So, as I said, there certainly is the concept of uninsurability. It was actually a great presentation at last year's ESSA convention, a panel discussion about uninsurability and the implications of it. Because, as I said, we've seen it in several places. We've seen it in America and Europe where it gets to a point where the reinsurers exit the market. What we had seen is there are then a state-sponsored reinsurer that would be introduced in order to pick up those risks. There's flood re in London, in England. There's similar ones for California wildfires. They don't come without their problems. It needs to be funded from taxes, from additional kind of government funds. So it's money that goes there that can't go elsewhere. There's also the problem of, anti-selection, no. Moral hazard gets worse because people aren't actually feeling the premium that they have to pay for the insurance cover. So they are less motivated to reduce their risk profile. There's consideration. I mean, Sasria, probably one of the biggest success stories in insurance for South Africa, really. The fact that without them, we would have struggled to get reinsurance cover in the 60s. There's talk of them potentially extending the perils that they cover to include things like climate change. Again, problem is how far they are stretched currently. And also, Sasria only insures the insured market. We're not talking about the very, very big uninsured market that's not covered by Sasria currently, and that wouldn't be here with the climate change, uninsurability increases. What I would say, what could be considered for you as an insurer is, this that comes up with climate change often, is resilience. It's really to understand, well, given the risks, what are the perils that you are most likely going to be exposed to? What is, again, climate change, you think that, well, it's going to get hotter. No, you're going to have floods, you're going to have wildfire, you're going to have cold snaps. Trying to understand which one of those you are more exposed to, and seeing that, well, how can you build that? How can you build the resilience? How can you brace yourself for more claims? And I would then even say, what can you do to help, prevent high claim count? I mean, if I think about the Durban floods, there a lot of critique, a lot of the costs were associated with the fact that government didn't step in. So it's a case of what can the insurance industry, independent of the government, kind of help and facilitate to prevent these high claim costs in the future.
Okay, thanks very much. If there are any more questions, please do send them through and we'll get them through to Chris to answer for you.
Thank you again, everyone.
But yeah, even for the last session of the day, you can see the hall was quite full. So well done on that. We really appreciate it. And just a small token to say thank you for your time. Thank you so much.